It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. You've probably heard of the new Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, designed by Frank Gehry. Well, if you call Gehry's rippling architecture original, our guest believes you have to call what's happening to food in Spain downright wild. Journalist Anya von Bremsen of Travel and Leisure magazine thinks that Spain has the most revolutionary food in all Europe. Jane and Michael Stern have discovered the paragon of pie in California. Fish and chips will take on a whole new identity after you hear from writer Matthew Goodman. We get a fondue report from a home kitchen in Switzerland, and we meet a man with a new take on the hungry artist theme. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, let's talk about new ways of creating great-looking tables. A little imagination goes a long way, whether it's for a weeknight dinner, a dress-up supper party, or a casual buffet. Anybody can go out and spend a fortune on brand-new table stuff and end up with something that looks good. But it's a lot more fun and a lot cheaper to use what you've got, or what you can pick up at garage sales and second-hand stores. Start by taking a new look at what you have around the house. For instance, bedspreads, shawls, or pieces of fabric can be great-looking table covers. Try layering them, pattern upon pattern. Think about whether an art pottery or glass collection might lend itself to being serving dishes. Make sure there's no lead in the glazes, then fill that urn with a green salad. Lay out marinated chicken breasts in that long, shallow bowl, or use the 1950s pottery planter for a green bean salad. If lead glaze is a problem, line the container with grape leaves or a doily and fill it with cold food. I collect old copper pots, and I sometimes use them as soup tureens or as stew pots. How about doing the same thing with tinware or Art Deco metal pieces? Put a sauce in a mortar, a crock, or a mixing bowl. A pretty teapot that's lost its lid becomes the easiest way to serve hot maple syrup at Sunday breakfast, or a sauce on a buffet. I can't resist old fabrics and linens. Old linen sheets, especially patched ones, aren't expensive, and the patching is frequently a work of art. I like to see it on a tabletop. Try this white-on-white routine. Drape your table with layers of fine old sheets and maybe top it with a big damask napkin. Set out white plates. They don't have to match. Use old, crisp white linen dish or tea towels as napkins. Set out your best silver. It doesn't have to match either. White votive candles, clear glasses, and then let the food be the centerpiece and the only color on the table. Unexpected small containers always bring a great touch to a table. It's like little surprise packages. You could use individual molds, like ones for Jell-O or brioche, to hold sugar. Collect bright little dishes and set them out at each place, holding ground pepper, salt, or maybe a special spice for a dish. We did a Moroccan dinner a while ago where at each place we had several unmatched seashells. Each one had a different ground and roasted spice in it, and everybody was invited to flavor each dish with a different melange of spices. At dessert, little unmatched dishes could hold lemon wedges for tea or cinnamon sticks for stirring into the coffee. This idea of salt cellars, that is, salt in a dish instead of a shaker, dates back a lot of centuries, to the times when salt was heavily taxed and really expensive. Salt cellars could be magnificent works of art, done for reigning nobility. Remember the expression, sitting above or below the salt? Well, above the salt meant high status. So this idea of each person having their little container of salt is about a history. Another fun touch are knife rests. They're bar-shaped and they're usually set at each place. They hold your knife blade above the cloth so it doesn't get stained. Our ancestors really didn't like doing laundry any better than we do. Now, usually knife rests are made of cut crystal or some precious metal. Instead, how about substituting inexpensive chopstick rests that you'll find in Asian groceries? Or take snippets of twigs from the garden and tie them together. Don't throw anything that's attractive away. My old teacups and saucers that long ago lost their siblings now hold jams and mustards on the buffet table. How about clustering together several 1950 coffee percolators in the center of a brunch table and filling them with flowers? Wacky? Sure, but why not? So, when you want to give your table a lift, take a new look at what you live with every day and tune in again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, where you'll find a complete assortment of fondue sets, including the Trudeau meat and cheese fondue set. This all-purpose fondue features both stainless steel meat pot and a stoneware cheese fondue pot in the same set. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Today we take a look at the most revolutionary food in Europe, and it's coming out of an incredibly tradition-bound country. Our guest is journalist Anya von Bremsen of Travel and Leisure magazine. She takes us to the site of the new Guggenheim Museum, the city of Bilbao in Spain. Evidently, Frank Gehry's wild and wonderful design for the museum fits right in with what's happening to food in Spain. Anya says Spanish chefs are leading diners into unheard-of realms. Now, if I say fish and chips, you think England, right? Well, maybe not after you hear from writer Matthew Goodman. Fondue is another national hallmark. Reporter Scott Haas trekked to Switzerland to get the local lowdown on making a true fondue, and he has details on how you can get kissed around the fondue pot. Forget the mistletoe. And we have found a new kind of culinary artist, or let's say a hungry artist who's fed his appetites in more ways than one. How about a single piece of chocolate that sells for $28,000? Then, as always, in the second half of the show, we'll be opening the lines for your calls. The number's 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column for Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, we've got a great solution if you want to have a fabulous pie around Christmas time, but you don't want to make it or don't know how to make a great apple pie. Simply send away to the Julian Pie Company in Santa Isabel, California. That's in the California desert. And they will send you some of the best apple pies ever.
Now, you know, why do I not associate pie with the California desert?
In fact, there are apple tree orchards at the edge of the desert. You know, the California desert is a peculiar place. It's not all arid. It's not all Death Valley. Around the sides of the desert, places like 29 Palms, there are oases. Uh-huh. And in fact, there are a lot of great apple orchards in and around the vicinity of the Julian Pie Company. These are local apples, and it's sort of on the way into the desert. You pass this place. And what's great about it, if you happen to be around there, is not only do they do mail order, but you can walk in and get a piece of warm apple pie to eat then and there. And even before you walk in, on the door that you push in, there's a little sign that says, "Begin smelling," because as you walk in, the aroma of baking apple pie is absolutely dizzying. And you can get them to slice one of these, not totally hot out of the oven, because that would be, after all, a little too hot, but warm from the oven, whatever kind of pie you want. They make several kinds of apple pie, and eat it right there.
You know, I don't think there has ever been a roadside pie place that Michael and I have not stopped in. And we're mostly disappointed. I mean, they often smell good, they look good, they're mm-hmm. quaint, they're charming. Mm-hmm. But when you actually put the fork in the pie and taste it, it's usually got a sort of a cardboard crust, or the filling is kind of yucky. This probably is the best apple pie I've ever eaten in my life. The crust is flaky. It is a deep dish apple pie, but the apples themselves have this very, very piquant flavor. It's not overly sugary. Just everything about it is perfect. And as Michael said, the aroma coming off this place is enough to pull you in from the road. Even if you're escaping from bank robbery, you have got to stop and have a piece of apple pie here.
Now, do they only do apple pies?
Well, they make many kinds of apple pie. They make boysenberry apple crumb pie. They make strawberry apple pie. They make apple rhubarb pie. And, in fact, they do make non-apple pies. Frankly, we didn't even bother to try the other pies. The one thing we did try that was not an apple pie was a little snack that they have in their case called simply pie crust. What this is a bite-sized, heart-shaped piece of crust that is baked in a veil of cinnamon sugar. So what it becomes is a cookie that kind of falls into flakes as soon as you put it between your teeth. Mm. It's really divine.
This sounds like Mom's Kitchen. Is this actually a bakery, or is it a place you actually can go, as you said, and sit and have pie?
Both. But it is primarily a bakery. You can watch the employees cut the apples, put them in the pies, bake the pies. Everything is done in an open kitchen, and it is just divine. And plus, you can mail order them, so you can, you know, for the holidays, you can less work for mother, as they used to say in the old Horn and Hart art.
Yeah, I'm putting away the apple slicer. This sounds good. Okay, let me review this. We're in where in California?
Santa Isabel, California, okay. On Highway 79.
And it's the middle of nowhere.
We're in the middle of nowhere in California, and it's the Julian Pie Company.
If you happen to be driving between San Diego and Palm Springs, you will pass it.
Well, next time I am, I'll just stop. Thanks, you two.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Listen to the fiddler play when it's playing till the break of day. For me, oh my, love that country pie. That's best strawberry, lemon, and lime. What do I care? Blueberry, apple, cherry, pumpkin, and plum. Call me for dinner, honey, I'll be there.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Square Meals, America's favorite comfort food cookbook. They're here every week, and every week you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. Matthew Goodman writes about Jewish food traditions, some of them quite unexpected, like the sweet bagels of Montreal or the restaurants being opened up around the country by a new wave of immigrants, Jews from Bukhara, a country in Central Asia. Matthew, good to talk to you again.
Hi, Lynn.
So what is the latest project?
Well, Lynn, I want to talk about a national dish, a very popular, well-known national dish. And like most national dishes, it's really a kind of a history lesson on a plate. It's associated, of course, with England, but its roots actually go all the way back to, of all things, the Spanish Inquisition.
What are we talking about?
Well, as you know, in the year 1492, Columbus didn't just sail the ocean blue. That was also the year that Ferdinand and Isabella kicked all the Jews out of Spain. And a lot of them ended up going south to Morocco, where they had a profound influence on the cuisine of that country. But a lot of them also ended up going north. And over the course of the next 100 years or so, a number of them ended up in England. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like all immigrants, they brought their own particular tastes and recipes and styles of cooking and so forth. And one of their favorite dishes was for fish fried in oil, which they served most often cold on the Sabbath because they were forbidden to cook on the Sabbath. And it was actually pretty unusual to fry fish in oil in England in those days. Most people used lard. But lard, of course, is made from pork, which is forbidden to Orthodox Jews. Mm-hmm. And so they used olive oil instead. And this dish became pretty popular, pretty well known around England, so much so that for a long time, up until the 19th century, it was known as fried fish the Jewish way. So then we are in the 19th century, and what happened in England is what happened in America. There was a wave of Ashkenazic Jewish immigrants, meaning that they had come from Eastern Europe. The original Jews coming from Spain are called Sephardic Jewish immigrants.
Okay.
And one of these Ashkenazic Jewish immigrants was a guy named Joseph Malin. It probably wasn't his real name, and that was probably Malinowski or something like that, but he called himself Joe Malin. And like a lot of immigrants, he went into the food services industry. And Joe Malin had the ingenious idea of taking this Sephardic Jewish dish of fried fish in oil and combining it with an Irish immigrant dish that was very popular at that time, fried potatoes, called chips. And he combined them in a shop that he set up. It was the first fish and chip shop in London. He's generally recognized as being the father of British fish and chips. So it's really pretty remarkable. You have an Ashkenazic Jewish immigrant taking a Sephardic immigrant Jewish dish, combining it with an Irish immigrant dish, and creating the British national dish.
And we thought fusion was a new deal.
The original fusion cookery.
You got it. Is the shop still there?
That shop is not still there, but there is another shop right in the center of London, called the Upper Street Fish Shop. And it's run by a guy named Alan Conway, who was the grandson of the original owners of that shop, Herschel and Hannah Koski, who were Jewish immigrants from Poland. And it's an extremely successful shop. It sells, it serves about 1,800 customers a week. Savoir magazine said it was the best fish and chips in London. And I had the opportunity to talk to this guy, Alan Conway, and I said to him, you know, why are you so successful? And he said it's because he uses the same recipes that his grandparents used. So if you're in London and you go to the Upper Street Fish Shop, you can ask Alan Conway for fish and chips made the traditional Jewish way, which is not to use flour in the batter, but to use matzah meal in the batter. And it turns out that matzah meal makes a really extraordinary fish and chips. The fish comes out golden brown, really kind of crunchy, faintly nutty. Mm. If you want to be authentic about it, you can sprinkle malt vinegar on it. And then, of course, they wrap it up in newspaper, probably one of those Rupert Murdoch tabloid dailies. Here in New York, we can use the Post, another Murdoch paper. It's probably what it's best used for. But we'll leave it up to your own listeners' discretion, I think.
Okay, so we're going to have the recipe up on the website. But now we know fish and chips is a Jewish dish.
A Jewish dish.
Matthew, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Matthew Goodman writes for the national Jewish publication, The Forward. You can get the recipe for the Upper Street Fish Shop's fish and chips. Now, that's fish fried in matzah meal. Well, you can get it two ways. Either send a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. Or go to our website. That is splendidtable.org. Coming up, the most revolutionary food in Europe and Swiss fondue on its home turf. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Maybe you've been noticing in the press these bits and pieces of reports on Spanish food. Evidently, there are big changes happening in Spain. Now, a lot of people are heading for Spain to see the new Guggenheim Museum. It's in the city of Bilbao. Now, Frank Gehry designed it, and it's stunning. But according to Travel and Leisure magazine's food critic, Anya von Bremsen, dining in Spain, specifically in the city of Bilbao, is just as exciting. Hey, Anya, it's good to have you back.
Thanks, Lynn. Good to be here.
So what is going on in Spain? What's happening with the food there?
Spain is just exploding with creativity, and nothing like this is going on in Italy, nothing in France like that. You have a birth of what one might term deconstructive cuisine. Everything looks different, it's not what you expect, and yet at the same time it evokes very specific food memories. It's just a highly flamboyant, a highly intellectual movement, and it started with the chef called Ferran Adrià, who cooks in Catalonia. And now it's spreading all across Spain, and eating there, it's not just a joy or delight, it's a real adventure.
Well, is he what I think of as the foam guy, the man who has created all these sort of dishes that are based on foams of food?
Well, that's sort of condensing his ideas into one word. In fact, he doesn't do foams anymore. But what he has done, he has changed the technique of food radically. So what you have is this ethereal cuisine, which is based on savory ice cream, on gelatins, on sort of foams. It's all this plays of textured. He destroyed the boundaries between courses. You don't have, you know, a first course, appetizer, dessert. Everything could be anything. And it's he's really justly called the Salvador Dali of the kitchen. It's crazy, but it tastes sublime.
Oh, well, now that's the key, because it sounds as though it could be bizarre.
Yes, exactly. But what makes it not bizarre is the deep, deep connection to tradition and culture. Nothing is there without a reason.
Why is this happening now in Spain, of all places?
I think it's a very interesting question. I thought about it a lot. No one really has ready-made answers. But I think what happened in Spain in the 70s after the death of Franco, that created such a cultural rupture that all the avant-garde just went sort of streaming out. You had Almodovar, you know, a filmmaker like Almodovar in Madrid. You had all this crazy, the tradition just sort of went out the window, which hasn't happened in Italy or France. And the other thing that's very important is the tradition of tapas, because people are used to different formats of food. They're used to sort of non-committal dining, where you can just drop by, taste something different. You're not stuck there for a seven-hour meal where everything has to be a specific way. So the Spanish are very open-minded when it comes to food and when it comes to other things as well.
When you talk about the tapas, you mean the tapas bars where there are little dishes?
Where there are little dishes. And what you had the very traditional little dishes. Then you had, for instance, a young chef who would train in a 3-Michelin-star kitchen. And then they would open their own tapas bars. And they did little dishes that were very creative and imaginative. It's a sort of small format that lets you play with different ideas. And people accept it.
It's the concept of bar food taken to the greatest heights, really.
Exactly.
Let's focus, though, on this new Guggenheim Museum. It's in the northern Spanish city of Bilbao, mm-hmm. and everybody's going to see it. I mean, I've talked to so many friends who are specifically planning trips to Spain just to go to the museum. What should we expect about dining there? Is there any great food to be had in Bilbao?
Well, Bilbao was up until the Guggenheim, a rather depressed city that still had a great tradition of shipbuilding, and, you know, with a strong middle class nevertheless. And the Basques are obsessed with cuisine. I mean, to them, it is everything. They have gastronomic societies. They talk about it constantly. So it already had a very strong culinary heritage and culinary tradition. And what's happening there right now, first of all attention is on Bilbao. The city is being reborn. There's new money. There's new tourism. It's just unprecedented. And what you have is The same movements that have been flourishing in Catalonia and elsewhere in the Basque country, like San Sebastian, finally they're coming to Bilbao. And for instance, the chef, the very young chef at the Guggenheim Bilbao, is really this young genius that, again, that creates this deconstructed cuisines. You know, he takes Basque, traditional Basque dishes, takes them apart, jolts them out of complacency, if you wish, and then puts them together in this incredible new ways. And also, because it's Frangieri, because it's the temple of design and architecture, it's incredible to look at. They have very special plates. You know, some of the plates resemble this undulating shape of the building, or this really striking presentation. They do this dessert tasting that I think about 7 or 8 small glasses and cups, each one holding something that you sort of barely recognize as food, and is just incredibly delicious.
Give me an example.
For instance, you have a lollipop that has, what do you call it, cotton candy, a sort of very light cotton candy that's flavored with rose water. And it's just tiny. It's just a bite. Or you have a rice pudding that's completely different and, again, deconstructed, you know, with sort of caramelized, you know, with bits of apple, things like that. And then there's a little passion fruit mousse that's, again, unlike anything like you've ever tasted.
And all of these are in little dishes. They're brought to you all at once, and you just sort of dip in and taste.
Yes.
Sounds incredible. This is actually the restaurant in the museum?
In the museum, yeah.
Okay, so we leave the museum. What about, what else might be there? Is there any other great eating in the city?
Well, there are a lot of really, really solid bourgeois traditional restaurants, you know, with 1 or 2 Michelin stars, but there are also new chefs. There's a place called Echanove in one of the new sort of architectural landmarks where the food is also extremely creative. You can go to a seaside suburb of Getxo, which is accessible by a subway designed by Sir Norman Foster, the architect. And there is a very young chef. You sort of expect this traditional seafood cuisine, and again, you get this sort of crazy. You get something, you get bacon ice cream with truffles and fish. And it sounds kind of, but it tastes incredible. And the other thing that the Basque Country and Bilbao in particular is known for are its tapas. You go to a tapas bar, and there are millions of them all over, but especially in the old quarter. And on the counter, there might be 40 or 50 different sandwiches, and they all look like, you know, like communion gear. They're all sort of done up in this lacy, frilly sort of mayonnaise, frou-frou, chopped egg. You know, the decoration is just pushed to the extreme, and it's really fun just to sit down and choose a couple, and you really can't stop eating. And then you go to the next one, and then they're even better.
This sounds like a great place to go. So if we go nowhere else in Spain, we go to see the Guggenheim, and then we eat our way through the city of Bilbao and its suburbs.
I have to say that as great as the food is in Bilbao, you have to, if you want incredible food, you have to go to San Sebastian, where it's taking even further. But Bilbao and San Sebastian will be the great, great gastronomic adventures of the new century.
And they're not very far away from each other.
About an hour.
Anya, thank you.
Pleasure.
Anya von Bremsen is contributing editor to Travel and Leisure magazine and author of the terrific Pacific Cookbook. Five years ago, you couldn't pay someone to take a fondue pot off your hands. Today, fondue is back big time. So recipes for cheese fondue are popping up faster than mushrooms after a rain. But here at the Splendid Table, we always go to the source. None of this shilly-shallying with American interpretations. Our intrepid and always hungry reporter, Scott Haas, is in Switzerland, where no one was ever silly enough to stop eating fondue.
What is fondue? When I think about fondue, I think about those horrible fondue parties of the 1960s and 1970s, the broad lapels, the brightly colored clothes, the forks with that horrible, you know, doughy bread being stuck into this glutinous cheese. But I thought to myself, you know, why throw out the fondue with the fondue pot? I'm here in Switzerland to find out the right way to make fondue. I wanted to learn the etiquette of fondue. I mean, it's the national dish of Switzerland, and they must know how to do it here the right way. There must be rules. There must be an etiquette. And I thought if I could learn this, I could come back to the States and have a real fondue party. I'm here in the capital of Switzerland in Bern with my two friends, Stephanie and Rado. Thanks for helping me out. I'm really looking forward to learning about how to do this the right way.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. Hello.
In other homes in Switzerland, are people making this fondue exactly the same way that you're doing it? I mean, is there one way to make fondue in Switzerland?
I think there are a lot of different ways to do it.
Uh-huh.
You may not know, but fondue, the origins are not really known. They just know that it has been prepared since the year 1530, roughly, and in various cantons, but mostly in the French-speaking cantons of Neuchâtel, Fribourg, and Waadt, Vaud. And the mix depends on the region. So it's Gruyère, it's Vacherin, and maybe Stephanie can add some others. Some people.
Emmentaler, you know, the cheese with the holes.
It's the classic Swiss cheese,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And some take Appenzeller, which gives it really a very strong taste.
It really depends on what you want. Okay, so what's the first thing we need to do? We need to, light the stove?
We have a gas stove.
So the first thing, the pot is heating.
No. Mm-mm. The first thing I did, I rubbed the pot with a clove of garlic.
Okay.
So it's really now, it looks and it shines with garlic and it smells
stinks.
Of garlic.
Mm-hmm.
So now we put in the wine and the remaining garlic and we heat it up.
Okay. Now we've sliced the garlic clove. It's really just about one clove of garlic. And we've sliced it into little pieces there. And then we go into the wine.
And then poured in some kirsch.
Kirsch is what?
Kirsch is schnapps. It's a kind of cherry schnapps.
That looks pretty strong.
And I stir it.
Wow, you can smell it.
And by the time the wine and the garlic boil, I will add it.
So something's happening to the wine right now. It's boiling. That's a good sign because I'm beginning to see that everyone looks pretty hungry right now. We want to get this fondue going. So what's the next thing we need to do?
You put the cheese in it.
Let's open the bag of cheese.
And it's extremely important that you stir it all the time.
Otherwise it'll get stuck.
It gets stuck.
Okay.
And
Stephanie will stir in an eight.
What do you mean stir in an eight?
In the form of an
eight. Oh, you stir a little bit. Oh, okay.
Eight.
An eight with the spoon. And that's because...
This is more authentic. No.
This is really how it has to be done.
Yes.
All right, so inside this bag, there's flakes of the Gruyere and the Emmentals.
Yes.
It's really nice looking. So it's actually been almost shredded.
Stare it.
There's another thing which has to be done, and I will do that now, namely to cut the bread.
Oh, that's a good
And the
idea.
Bread should never be fresh. It should be one day old.
Really?
Yes, yes. So that it's not so gluey anymore. It should be a bit, just a little bit crusty.
I would never have thought that. I would always think that the bread should be fresh.
No, it has to be. It has to be like that.
So, can I ask you something, Stephanie? What else do you serve with fondue? Do you serve a salad with it? Do you serve,
never salad.
No.
So, fondue is just fondue. It's cheese and this bread.
Why do you serve nothing with the cheese?
Well, I think it's a very heavy meal,
actually.
I guess it's also a tradition.
Right.
And you don't even have a dessert.
Okay. Well, it does look beautiful. So should we eat it? Let's do it. Let's bring it over to the table. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Everybody takes a handful of bread.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
I have a fondue fork in my hand.
Exactly.
I spear the bread.
And you
dip it in the fondue.
Then you dip it. And then you make a shape, whatever you like. You can make the eight, go on with the eight, or go round, or just up
whatever
and
you like.
Down, whatever you like.
Right, I'm just going to dip it in here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Real Swiss fondue. All right, we dip it in. Rita, you're dipping it in too. Oh, you made a really fancy shape. I'm just dipping mine in.
You have to dip it because you have to stir. It's the continuation of the stirring. People should now all eat, and by eating and stirring in it, in the fondue, it will not, the wine will not separate from the cheese. Because otherwise the wine will come to the surface.
So there's a reason why we're stirring.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I just had a piece. That's delicious. Mm. It's very different. And what's interesting to me, too, is that when you keep talking about tradition and meditation, this is a very intimate experience. All of us putting our forks in the same, I mean, our mouths are touching these forks. So there's sort of a communal germ thing going on here. I mean, yeah. It's a family meal.
Rito?
I have to say, yes. Oh, you just dropped a piece of bread in the fondue.
It has a certain meaning.
That's a certain meaning.
They say the person who drops a piece has to pay the next round of wine.
Well, I started to eat fondue with friends of mine, too. And then you had to kiss somebody.
Anyone.
You liked.
Oh.
And you could decide somebody to kiss.
So why aren't we all accidentally dropping our bread into the fondue and running around kissing one another?
I told you I was a teenager then, uh-huh. And then it's more difficult. Uh-huh. I mean, when you get older, it's more like Reto says, you have to play around for everybody. Cheers. Cheers.
Well, Stephanie Rado, I really wanted to thank you for taking the time to show me how to do it the right way, to show me the etiquette of Swiss fondue.
Thank you very much. Oh, thank you for joining us.
And we enjoyed the meal, and we hope you did too.
Absolutely. It was wonderful. Thank you again.
The ever-famished reporter Scott Haas writes and eats in Boston. Just call us. We have opened the lines for your calls, and the number is 800-537-5252. Anything you want to talk about, we'll give it a shot. So let's get right to the phone. We've got John on the line. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I'm good. What are you thinking about, John?
I'm thinking about toffee, chocolate pecan toffee.
Well, hey.
Okay.
This is good. Okay.
Okay, I've got this recipe that I've used a lot. I make it for gifts and, you know, for the holidays.
Right, right.
I don't really have a problem with it. The family recipe, I kind of fancied it up with better chocolate than the standard, you know, candy bar. And the problem I have is that since there's no preservatives or anything like that in it,
yeah,
it's very sensitive to, I'm not even going to say heat. I'm just going to say, you know, warmth, whatever. So when you pick it up, it tends to melt in your hands and not in your mouth.
Oh, all right. Tell me how you make it. Quick, just briefly, you know.
Brown sugar, you know, butter, bring it to 325, pour in a Pyrex dish, you know, with the nuts, and then put the chocolate down and put more nuts over it, and then, you know, cool it to harden it.
What kind of chocolate are you using? You're using a really good quality one, right?
Right. Either, I can't pronounce these, Valrhona.
Valrhona, yeah.
Or Calibo.
Yeah, they're two very good brands.
Yeah.
And now each one of those has different formulas, and some of them might have a slightly higher percentage of cocoa butter. Now, cocoa butter is that fat that's going to stay firm at room temperature.
Right. So I guess this is the higher the cocoa butter content, the better off I would be.
Yeah, and that may mean the lower the cocoa mass. And on Valrhona, I know they actually show a percentage.
A percent.
And I'd say go for something like the 51% or something like that instead of like the 70%. See if that changes it. It may not, but it's worth a try.
So go for the lower cocoa butter.
The lower cocoa mass.
Lower
because
cocoa.
That'll probably have higher cocoa butter.
Okay.
But in the meantime, I like licking my fingers and your toffee sounds great.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your show.
Hey, John, thanks for calling.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Well, it's time for our trivia question of the week. It was inspired by hearing so much about cheese fondue. So here's the question. What's the key to keeping fondue from getting stringy and separating? Again, what's the secret to keeping fondue from getting stringy and separated? We will be back in a moment with that answer, more of your calls, and a new take on food is art. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We'll get back to your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. Here it is. What's the key to keeping cheese fondue from getting stringy and separating? Well, this answer is straight from the genius of our favorite food scientist, Shirley Currier. The key is the wine in the fondue. Evidently, certain cheeses, like some from Switzerland, have a good bit of calcium phosphate in them. All you have to remember is the calcium part. When you melt cheese, what happens is the cheese's proteins unwind and become what look like long floating ribbons. Well, the cheese separates and gets stringy because the calcium makes hooks. And essentially, it hooks one piece of protein ribbon to another, and that makes for string, and it stops being creamy and smooth melted cheese. Now for the magic ingredient. Certain white wines have an acid similar to the citric acid in lemon juice. When that acid meets up with the calcium in the cheese, it envelops it in this big bear hug. And that hug stops the calcium from forming those hooks. So, presto, the melted cheese is smooth. So when the Swiss tell you to keep stirring the fondue as you dip your bread into it, what they're really doing is keeping those acids hugging that calcium. Shirley says that lemon juice does the same thing. So if you get strings in your melted cheese, you know, if it starts to separate, just stir in some lemon juice. And, meanwhile, back at your home cappuccino machine, you know that dried, milky buildup you get on the nozzle? Well, that's calcium hooking up with protein. The easiest way to clean it is just wipe it with lemon juice. That is our food science lesson for the day, courtesy of my pal Shirley Currier. Well, the phones are going full bore, so let's get back to your calls. Again, the number's 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up? Dick is here. Dick, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I was calling to talk to you about truffles.
Truffles,
right? Because sometimes we have had truffles in various meals in Italy, usually white truffles, and they've been absolutely sublime.
Right.
And then other times we've had truffle meals different places, and we've bought fresh black truffles usually and used them. And sometimes there's really not much taste at all there. And so we're wondering, what are all the reasons for that? What makes a truffle meal sometimes incredible and sometimes just not worth the time?
Oh, golly. This is a complicated one, Dick.
Yeah.
Well, I don't claim any tremendous expertise here. I've spent a fair amount of time in the truffle area of Italy. There's one thing I think everybody should understand, that truffles grow in a lot of places around the world, but it seems that the ones that are the most exciting, the most delicious, the most fragrant, the black ones from the Perigord area of France, essentially south central France, and then these fabulous white truffles from the Piedmont region of northwestern Italy, specifically in the area around the town of Alba. Now, there's black truffles, in Italy, and there's probably white truffles in France, and they're of varying degrees of quality.
Mm-hmm.
But even when you're in a prime area, you can have either a bad season or the truffle has been hanging around too long. I understand that if it's much too dry, you have very few truffles and they're not terribly fragrant. If they've not been treated properly, you know, if they've not been stored properly and kept properly, that's another reason. And there's just low-grade truffles. This doesn't give you a full answer to your question, but I think this is one of the reasons why when people say, oh, I've invested in a can of truffles, I want to say, you know, please don't bother because, well, there are some very good quality packers. Urbani is one from Italy that has good canned truffles. But the fact of the matter is you can't know a truffle until you smell it fresh. And it should be so intense that it would fill the room. Otherwise, it's not worth the investment. And I gather you've experienced this kind of intense, wonderful.
We have. We've had some extraordinarily good, usually white truffle meals. But sometimes we've bought black truffles especially. And some, of course, you're right. Sometimes they just don't smell of anything very strongly, and sometimes they smell a lot more.
Yeah.
We were beginning to wonder, because we're getting different stories, whether one should ever cook the black truffles. Well, some sources say, well, you should cook them a little bit to bring out the flavor, and other people say never cook them at all.
Well, you know, one of the great classic ways in France, and we're talking about the French black truffle, is that it's wrapped in something, like foil or whatever, and it's cooked in the cinders of a fire. It's, you know, roasted that way. Another way that it's preserved, and I've had them this way, and they are incredible. They're preserved the way you would do a goose or a duck, you know, in the fat of the goose or duck, where it's actually lightly cooked. The one that you should never cook is the white truffle.
Right.
It kills it.
Okay.
I've got a funny story for you, by the way.
Okay.
A man who was the head of tourism many years ago in the town of Alba, which is one of the capitals for white truffles in Italy, said that in attempting to build good relations with the head of tourism of all of Italy in Rome, the people of the Piedmont sent him to Rome with the biggest truffle that was harvested that year. And he presented it to this man, and he was telling me the story to show how the people in Italy from one region to another do not know each other's foods. Okay? So he gave this to this gentleman, and the next day met him for lunch, and the man never said a word about this phenomenal truffle. So finally he said to him, excuse me, but how did your family like the truffle? And he said, well, you know, I brought it home to my wife, and she boiled it for about 4 hours, and, you know, it was just tasteless. And, of course, he almost fainted.
Yes.
It was like taking gold and, you know, throwing it into the ground.
Yes.
I would say I don't think there's anything wrong with cooking a black truffle if the truffle starts out being a great truffle. But with a white truffle, you want it raw.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. By the way, it's truffle season right now. And, of course, it's the holidays. It's the time of year that you start thinking a bit about splurging. You will find fresh black and white truffles in fancy markets across the country, and probably a lot of people are mail ordering them. Just remember, a great truffle should be so aromatic that you can smell it across a room. If it's not that good, don't waste the money. Alan's on the line. So, Alan, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Lynn, it's nice to talk to you. I miss you. I've got to tell you up front that I can't hear you anymore because where I've moved to the mountains of North Carolina, I can't get a station that has your program.
Alan, you've got to get a house somewhere else, at least when the show's on.
I should have asked first before I moved.
I understand that the mountains of North Carolina are really glorious, though.
Oh, it's gorgeous. There are no troubles here, but they're beautiful.
Oh.
So I'm building my third house.
All right.
It's going to be a Japanese kind of house, and we're going to do another kitchen.
Right.
We've done previously. And we're getting professional stoves and all the right stuff because my wife and I love to cook. I mean, we live to cook, and we enjoy good food. And we mail order a lot. And thanks to you, a lot of your sources have been very helpful to us.
Great.
But what I can't find, I mean, I can find the great ranges and the stoves and the refrigerators and the sinks, et cetera, et cetera. But a freestanding rotisserie doesn't seem to be the kind of thing that you can find without, you know, looking really hard and maybe, if you're lucky, finding something industrial. I'm looking for something that has industrial overtones to it, so it's going to be withstand use and hold up. I can't find anything, with the exception of one. I just brand names over the air is no big deal.
No.
Royal King is the one that I've stumbled on. That seems to be the, and it was originally made in the Bronx years ago, and that makes me feel good. So, you know,
it's important
be,
to
right?
know the origin of these things. So you want to know sources, you're saying.
I was wondering if you had any experience with freestanding roads. I've been surfing the net. And the freestanding rotisseries that you find, a lot of them that are industrial, are made in Texas and other places where they can do 30, 40 chickens at a time for these real professional stores.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not about to get into, you know, 40 chickens at a clip. But one is nice, but most of it, you know, is done, you know, you see it on these infomercials, you see these rotisseries, and I'm a little inclined not to want to go that way because they, you know, the price usually indicates that maybe it's not the best made thing in the world. I had one built into an oven back in New York.
Yeah.
But they don't build them in the ovens anymore.
They used to. I remember a long time ago you could get like, it was like a rod that went into the side of the oven and it turned the whatever you wanted to roast in front of the heat.
Best steaks and chickens I've ever had in my life.
You know, if you're reminding me, I don't know about sources for the industrial type you're talking about, and yet I understand where you're coming from. You want something that's going to hold up and do a dynamite job.
Exactly.
And I think your sensibilities are in the right place. Sadly, I don't have a brand for you. You know what might be worthwhile to do, though?
Tell me.
Is, are there any good restaurants in your area that do this kind of thing? Or restaurateurs you know of across the country that you've read about? Because I, you know, chefs can be incredibly generous in terms of saying, here's a brand we've worked with. Maybe the one we work with does 40 chickens, but who knows? They may make a smaller one. You follow my reasoning?
Yeah, exactly. And maybe the thing to do is call a couple of these manufacturers, see if they've got something that they're fooling around with. They might want to try something.
That's right. And the other thing is, if you talk to people who use them, they're going to give you the poop on, hey, this is a great product or this isn't.
It's a good idea.
Because obviously you're investing a good deal of money and effort into this, and you certainly want something that's going to hold up. I'm remembering, you know, you're reminding me of something that we just experienced about a month ago, and this is not what you're looking for, but do you remember those old Farberware stovetop?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, well, you know, my husband ran across one in a garage sale, and he remembered 20 years ago having one and making great roast on it. In fact, it was before we were married. It had to be more than that. Anyway, he bought it for $4. It looked like it had never been used. I thought, you know, come on, this is ridiculous. Well, we did a pork roast on it. It was incredible. But the problem was, we have limited power in our kitchen. We have a very old house. The problem was, the plug started to melt.
Because of the power?
I think so. I think this thing pulls an awful lot of power.
Oh, I'll bet.
And by the way, I have a feeling in another kitchen, they wouldn't have this problem. But what was interesting to me was this $4 Farberware rotisserie / grill did the most incredible job.
Well, and, you know, they made things in those days a little differently, I think.
They did.
Made better.
Yeah.
I really believe that.
But I'd say start calling around to people you know do this kind of cooking. You know, check the magazines. I wish I could offer you something more concrete than this.
Well, you know,
Alan.
I called a couple of sources, like, you know, catalogs that I know are high-end.
Yeah.
None of them sold anything like this.
I talk to the cooks because they're the ones who tell you.
And I'll tell you what, because I'm going to wind up doing something. At some point in time, it's going to happen. I'm going to have a rotisserie in the kitchen. And I'll call you and tell you how it worked.
Please do. No, because this is the kind of thing we can share with other people. And think about a once-a-week house where you can hear the show.
I might have to do something about this.
This is good. Alan, thank you. And good luck.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Goodbye. You know, why don't they keep those rotisseries in ovens anymore? They were really great. And it was fun, you know? Oven manufacturers out there? This is something for you to think about. I saw something in a magazine a while ago that I had to follow up on. Let me set this up for you. An artist chooses a medium and subject matter because these best express what he or she wants to say. Artist Peter Anton works with food. Well, sort of. He's joining us by phone. Peter, welcome.
Hi.
Can you describe a piece for us? For instance, maybe like what was the first piece you ever sold?
Okay. Yeah, the first piece I ever sold was in 1993 at a gallery in Washington, D.C., and it was called Tea Party. It was a three-foot pile of giant dirty dishes with half-eaten desserts, like cakes and cream puffs and pastries, all piled up on this three-foot pile. Who, very colorful and fun.
Who bought it?
A collector from Washington, D.C. area, some family that owns department stores down there, something. So some big-time art collector. So that was my first sale, and that was very, very exciting because that was also my first solo exhibition.
Oh, gosh, I can imagine. Now, what materials? I mean, you don't work with the real food, right?
No, no. I use plaster, wire, clay, all different kinds of materials. But in the studio, I have lots of food always around because I have to use it as the models. So I have it in different stages. And, like, I have it frozen to keep it fresh, and then as it thaws, the color starts coming in. And sometimes I have it freshly cooked so I can see the colors and the textures. And I do also large chocolate sculptures, so the studio is filled with all half-bitten chocolate candy pieces everywhere.
Is this chocolate sculpture, or is this a series of works?
Yeah, the chocolate sculptures are actually the pieces that I'm most famous for now. They are giant 3x4-foot boxes of chocolates, and they're in their ruffled papers, and some of them are pinched and bitten to reveal the texture, I mean the colors and the filling that's inside. And some of them are left whole, and some of the papers are empty. And, yeah, those are very, very popular for me right now.
This sounds like exactly what a chocolate box looks like at our house.
Is that how you eat chocolate?
Well, you know, what's inside and the whole thing. What does that run in price?
Those are $28,000.
Ah, a bagatelle. So what's next after the chocolate series?
Right now I'm working on giant ice cream bars. And these are about 5 feet high, and they're bitten and crackled, and you can see the frozen, the dew that goes on ice cream and all the frozen little ice crystals, and they're very exciting.
So, Peter, every artist has a message. What's your message?
My message is enjoy life, have fun, and celebrating life. That's really the most important thing.
And pinch the chocolate and see what's inside. Hey, Peter, thank you.
Thanks.
Artist Peter Anton works in the basement of his home in Guilford, Connecticut. Well, everybody, that's the show for today. I'm glad you could join us. Come on back next week. And remember, you can call us anytime at 800-537-5252. Let me leave you with something to mull over while watching the election brouhaha. It comes from that expert on power and manipulation, Otto von Bismarck. He said, "To retain respect for sausages and laws, one must not watch them in the making." The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, offering the latest assortment of tea kettles with flip-up whistles, 1810 stainless steel exteriors, and heat-resistant handles. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lupke and Jennifer Russell. The theme music is by Billy Barber, with additional music inspiration from Rob Hebzinski. Our fondue piece was produced by John Marston. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.